Volunteering is something very important, especially for our generation. We need to teach people that giving doesn't always mean that you need to take something in return. So we're here to volunteer with our time, to try to help people as much as we can. So Sa'ad Association is our vessel to do that.
Today we came to make meals for the people in need. First we cut the vegetables, then we shredded the chicken. And now we are cooling down the rice and the chicken. Then we're going to put it in boxes and give it to people in need.
Despite the United States' theft of their resources and the inhuman sanctions imposed upon them, which have put Syrians in dire living conditions, they steadfastly hold on to their love for their country. United against all the odds, they strive to find their way through this dark tunnel towards the dawn of a brighter life.
Syrians have always firmly stood together, not only against terrorism, but also in the face of unjust Western sanctions, through voluntary initiatives that show their love to each other and to their homeland. Ibrahim Wahid, Damascus.
Since the Al-Aqsa flood operation and the Israeli genocidal aggression against Gaza began early October last year, Hezbollah has taken a stance of defense against Israeli military targets near Lebanon's southern border. Now, months later, a propaganda campaign has been launched against such efforts, with social media posts and bulletin boards across the Lebanese capital, Beirut, and beyond reading slogans such as "Implementing international resolutions enhances stability" or "Lebanon does not want war."
If you asked all Lebanese whether they would want an Israeli war to begin in Lebanon, the unanimous response would be no, especially with decades of experience with the Israeli regime and its disproportionate targeting of civilians. Yet what seems like a simple billboard has deeper implications for a country like Lebanon.
Experts tell Press TV that certain groups in Lebanon have launched this campaign to put people against the resistance at a time of war. But are these factions working alone?
This campaign, we can say that it doesn't represent the Lebanese people, and especially in that it is, and we have informations, it is funded by foreign countries.
Those parties and those factions, they were controlled by the U.S. Embassy in Beirut. The U.S. Ambassador, Dorje Shea, as she was departing Beirut and also receiving her successor, Lisa Johnson, they were working on this in a way that would, help Amos Hochstein and his pressures put on Lebanon.
Hochstein, who is an Israeli-American businessman and lobbyist, has gone back and forth from Beirut to Tel Aviv in attempts to stop the resistance operations, without any mention of an end to Israeli violations of Lebanon's rights, which have persisted for over 17 years.
By supporting the resistance in Gaza or in Palestine, the resistance in Lebanon have prevented war. It didn't start the war. And especially when the Lebanese people and the Palestinian people and the Iraqi people and all people in the world are not protected by the international decisions.
Some people inside Lebanon, they are working as agents of the Americans and the Zionists, unfortunately, trying to accuse Hezbollah and the resistance of false things, misinformation, though it is crystal clear that the resistance is trying to protect Lebanon.
With growing popular support and despite the pressure from foreign and domestic sides, Hezbollah has been adamant on proceeding with its supportive military operations as long as the Israeli onslaught against Gaza continues. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the holy prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asle zinde ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. Please stay tuned. How can we bless our New Year celebrations during Nowruz? Is it possible through eating sweets, visiting their relatives, or wearing new clothes? What are the best criteria for blessing our lives? One of the good ways to bless our lives is to help the needy among our friends and relatives. But another good way is to start a new year by helping our brothers and sisters in faith. This is one way to bless our lives.
بیایم جهازی دختر فلانی رو حلش کنیم فلانی سه تا پسر داره نمیتونه اینا رو دماد کنه.
One another way to bless our lives at the beginning of the new year during springtime is to buy dowries for the newlywed girls. Another way is to give money to the young boys to help them financially who want to get married. In this way, we can make our new year Mubarak or blessed. Making a heart happy is one of the best ways to bless our life with blessings of Allah. New Year celebration is not necessarily being happy, but sharing happiness with others. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. To find out more about this program, please log on to our website, parstoday.ir Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
The former U.S. President and Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump has a long history of racist statements, having launched his successful 2016 presidential campaign by describing undocumented migrants crossing the southern border with Mexico as rapists and drug dealers. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. 33 people attempting to cross the U.S. border with Mexico drowned in the Pacific Ocean near San Diego after the Trump administration nearly doubled the height of the walls along the southern border, a staggering increase from previous years. According to a study published recently, the number of drownings rose by 3,200%. From 2020 to 2023, compared to 2016 to 2019, when just one person drowned. By 2019, the Trump administration had elevated the barriers around San Diego from 17 feet to 30 feet. The expansion has had significant impacts and a major human toll. In addition to the drowning deaths, a 2022 study found an unprecedented increase in border wall falls and deaths. Donald Trump campaigned on the so-called promise of securing America's borders while routinely demonizing immigrants, and work on the border barrier has continued under the Biden administration. Last year, doctors in San Diego saw more than 400 patients who had been seriously injured at the border wall, a significant increase from 2022. Nearly all of the injuries occurred from people falling off the wall onto the U.S. side of the border. The authors of the study published in the JAMA Journal recently suspected that the increased risk associated with the border barrier may have encouraged people to try to enter the United States by water, which resulted in more deaths. They found a significant rise in deaths in San Diego, where the wall stretches across the sand into the water at Imperial Beach, as well as a 30% rise in drowning deaths in canals and a 133% increase in deaths in all other bodies of water. Drownings along the Rio Grande River, where there is largely no wall, remained almost unchanged. The authors of the report, Anna Lucia, a medical student at the University of California at San Diego, and Peter Lindholm, a professor at the same university, began exploring the issue after Anna Lucia noticed a lack of information on drowning deaths of people trying to cross the border. They had been looking at the occupational health of lifeguards and other workers. Lucia said in a statement from the University of California at San Diego, the lifeguards showed us a presentation on migrant rescues they were performing because of potential human smuggling. Their stories weren't showing up in the news, and the numbers struck me as odd. Anna Lucia looked at data on the drowning deaths within government data sets, but it was not readily available and missing critical information. She and Professor Peter Lindholm ultimately collected data from the Missing Migrants Project, which included the date and coordinates of drownings as well as the number of people who had died. The authors of the report plan to expand their research to better understand the rise in deaths, But Professor Lindholm said the increase is unlikely due only to an increase in immigration. He said, looking at the numbers, you can see that it's about the same in the Rio Grande River, and it's a little more, but not extraordinarily more, in the ditches and canals. He added, we don't have absolute data on how many people migrated, but if the numbers of drownings was related to the rate of immigration, you would probably have a similar increase at all places. The website Reddit has also covered the same story and tells us more. Reaching for racist rhetoric, bizarre even for him, Donald Trump compared undocumented migrants to the United States to Hannibal Lecter, the serial killer and cannibal famously played by Sir Anthony Hopkins in the Oscar-winning 1991 film The Silence of the Lambs. The former U.S. president and Republican presidential nominee claimed in an interview with Right Side Broadcasting Network on Monday, 4th of March, they're rough people in many cases from jails, prisons, from mental institutions, insane asylums, adding, you know, insane asylums, that Silence of the Lambs stuff, Hannibal Lecter. Anybody know Hannibal Lecter? To laughter from the audience at his Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida, Trump added, we don't want him in this country. Trump has made such statements before, including in his speech at the Conservative Political Action Conference in Maryland last month. As framed to Right Side, they were the latest piece of extremist and dehumanizing invective from a candidate seeking to make immigration a core issue of the 2024 presidential campaign. Donald Trump has a long history of such racist statements, having launched a successful 2016 presidential campaign by describing Mexicans crossing the southern border into the U.S. as rapists and drug dealers. His liking for Hannibal Lecter led him to claim at a rally last October that the actor who played the character said on television, I love Donald Trump, so I love him. Anthony Hopkins has not publicly said he loves Donald Trump. In 2018, he said, I don't vote because I don't trust anyone. Brian Cox, another actor to have played Hannibal Lecter on screen, has called Trump an idiot person. In 2016, Mads Mikkelsen, who played Hannibal Lecter on television, told CBS News that though he could definitely laugh at some of the stuff that Donald Trump has said, he can also go, oh my God, did he really say that? Donald Trump is an alleged serial offender facing 91 criminal charges as he runs for office. Yet despite those charges, 17 of them for election subversion, 40 of them for retention of classified information, and 34 for hush money payments to a movie actress, and multi-million dollar civil penalties over his business affairs and a rape allegation, a judge called substantially true, Trump dominates the Republican primary. He also leads Joe Biden in most general election polling. Surveys subject to warnings from experts about sampling techniques and accuracy so far out from Election Day. As in his successful run for president in 2016, Trump is seeking to use problems at the southern border with Mexico, high numbers of arrivals from Central America, presented as a crisis, either real or not, as a central campaign issue. At his direction, Senate Republicans sank a bipartisan deal on border and immigration reform. House Republicans have refused to move on the issue. President Biden has sought to emphasize Trump and Republicans' refusal to work on solving the border problem. President Biden's campaign has also repeatedly slammed Donald Trump for using far-right fascistic language, When discussing migrants, including the repeated claim that migrants are poisoning the blood of America, the Biden campaign directly compared those remarks to Adolf Hitler's rhetoric during his rise to power in Germany.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Not facing a U.S. veto this time, the U.N. Security Council finally called for an immediate ceasefire in the Gaza Strip, which has so far fallen on Tel Aviv's deaf ears. Israel defiantly insists it will perform an operation on Rafah, where 1.5 million Palestinians have taken shelter. This has faced global criticism and stern warnings, even from Israel's closest ally, the U.S. In the meantime, truce negotiations are still ongoing in Doha, Qatar, though with no breakthrough. So far, Israel's Holocaust in Gaza has killed more than 32,000 Palestinians. Some 500,000 Gazans are already facing starvation, and many more are on the brink. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and these are our guests in this episode. Kim Sharif, activist and lawyer, is joining me from London. Also with us is Shabir Rizvi, political commentator in Chicago.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, let me welcome both our guests. Welcome, both of you. So, beginning with Kim. Kim, you're a lawyer. At last, the U.S. abstained, deciding not to use its veto power at the U.N. Security Council. What, in your mind's eye, motivated Washington to do so? And does this mean a change of heart in its policies vis-a-vis the Tel Aviv regime? Is it a publicity stunt or what?
Yeah, good afternoon to you. It seems to me that after I've analyzed the situation very carefully and I've been thinking about it and I've listened very carefully to the speech of the U.S. representative at the U.N. Security Council as to why they have abstained, it is very obvious to me, and I don't know about others, but it's very obvious to me that it was a publicity stunt. The U.S. is aware that the whole world is now totally against its position in relation to supporting this genocidal regime. And it has lost a moral compass, it has lost the moral authority, it has lost a great deal perhaps we can't even measure it at this stage. And therefore, it has decided to take this position make it seem like it is concerned and it wants the right thing to happen and so forth. But when you listen to the speech of the U.S. representative at the Security Council, you will see that her entire focus and attention was on basically blaming and deflecting, blaming the whole delay in getting the resolution voted on the Chinese and the Russians, and forgetting completely that they themselves three times vetoed a proposal to end the genocidal campaign of the Israeli regime. And so it seems to me that this was clearly a political stunt, because if they really wanted to stop, if they really want to stop the genocide, the Holocaust in Palestine, today all they have to do is make a phone call, and I'm pretty confident that they will be obeyed, because they will be able to cut military aid, they will be able to cut all kinds of other aid, they will be able to put to bear a huge pressure on them, they will be able to sanction them. Okay. So it is this stunt doesn't work, and I am not persuaded. I don't know about others.
Okay, now, Shabir, all UN Security Council resolutions are considered binding, and this is in accordance with Article 25 of the UN Charter, which is ratified by the United States. But this one, the U.S. has described the Monday resolution as non-binding. How's that?
Yeah, it's certainly interesting. I mean, I think if we need to actually analyze history, there are actually dozens of UNSC resolutions that Israel has violated. Time and time again, we see it with the West Bank, we see it with Gaza, we see it with Lebanon. This is an occupation that cannot be trusted. And so what the United States is doing is they're saying it's non-binding. Why are they saying it's non-binding? Because they know right now Israel has become a pariah state. And not only has it become a pariah state, in the eyes of the international community, I would say, a lot of us have known from the very start it's been a pariah state. But all eyes are on Israel. Its image has never been more tattered. Its image has never been this horrific in the eyes of the international community. So what the United States is doing right now is saving face of its most loyal junior partner and saying that these are non-binding, in that it knows that Israel is going to violate the ceasefire resolution, whatever its terms may be. In fact, they're already violating it. There were several bombings last night. There were several massacres last night. And so what we see is that Israel is very much intent on continuing this carnage. And so, for one, the United States is trying to save face. And two, we know that from the get-go, the Israeli occupation will not honor this resolution, no matter what its terms may be.
Right. Now, Kim, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has canceled a visit of a ranking delegation to Washington, seemingly in protest at Monday's UN Security Council resolution, you know. And Bibi's already facing division among cabinet members, also opposition from the Israeli people who've been out on the streets for a long time, holding rallies against him and his policies. So would he, in your opinion, eventually get off his high horse, or would he still persist to act stubbornly?
I think this act of canceling his visit to the U.S. is just another one of those media game that they play to make it seem like, you know, they are now in a tiff. But that's not true, because if they are in a tiff, the genocide, the Holocaust would stop tonight. And that's a fact. Everyone knows it. And we don't need to be mincing our words about that. And this man's life, livelihood, political career, everything, together with his wife also, who's been accused of certain things, depends on continuation of this Holocaust in Gaza, because up to now, 6 months later, all he has achieved is damage the reputation of Israel in the world, cut its own possible benefit that it may have derived from any other sources if they had taken different course in relation to dealing with October the 7th. And so he's now in a situation where he hasn't achieved any of his objectives from the time he entered Gaza, other than committing a Holocaust that people are now comparing it to the Nazi Germany of the Second World War. And so him pretending that he's not going is to give America some kind of gravitas to, in the world platform, to make America seem like, you know, it's now taking a very firm stance towards Israel. And the reality is far from that. If it wants to take a firm stances, for them to say, stop it now or else we are going to apply sanctions on you. We're going to send our troops there to you to make sure that you don't invade, do what you're threatening to do in Rafah. And do that kind of thing. They have done that many times before, right, in relation to many other people, but not in relation to Palestine, because they are a party to this Holocaust. The U.S. regime is a party to this Holocaust. So right. is the U.K., unfortunately. Yemen is the only one that is upholding the international rule of law.
Right. Now, Shabir, officials in Tel Aviv have taken no heed of the U.N. call for ceasefire, nor have they abided by the ICJ ruling. So what else can be done to force the regime to stop this genocide or Holocaust or whatever else you call in Gaza?
Yes. So as we know, Israel is a pariah state. It doesn't care for what international mechanisms are being used against it. And so what it's going to have to come down to is that countries will have to take a bold stance. They're going to have to economically cut ties with the Zionist state. They're going to have to cut political ties with the Zionist state. They will have to turn to their own workers and their own local businesses and say, you cannot do business with the Zionist regime. This is what it's going to have to come down to. That, and of course, uplifting the resistance and politically backing the resistance. Because as you know, under international law, resistance against an occupying enemy is completely justified. As soon as that justification is made well known, and it's honored internationally, as we saw China made similar comments a few weeks ago, we are going to see slowly but surely, sort of just like how apartheid South Africa was diminished, the same diminishment of the Israeli regime. Right now, it's basically being politically, as it always has, it's being politically backed and militarily backed by the United States. As soon as countries are able to independently say we will no longer do business with the Zionist regime, that is when that first domino will fall, and it will create a cascading effect that's going to take care of the Israeli regime, that's going to make it eventually fall, because it cannot stand on its own two legs without any political and economic assurances from basically the Western world.
Mm-hmm. Now, Kim, let's now review Israel's failure in the Gaza war. Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh is now in Tehran, and he says that Palestinians have shown, in his words, legendary resistance in the war, and that Israel has failed to achieve any of its military objectives. Let's face it, it's a fact. IOF has failed to defeat even one single Palestinian resistance group.
Yes, this is remarkable. It's been 75 years or so that this regime has been applying this genocidal schemes, because genocide is not a one-off action of one party against another. Genocide is a process that takes time. So over the past 75 years, they have been applying this genocidal policy towards the Palestinian people, yet, remarkably, they remain steadfast, strong, and carry on their resistance operation, which is their inalienable right guaranteed by the UN Charter, and occupied people are entitled to do whatever is necessary to resist the occupation. And the occupation doesn't have rights. The occupation has obligations to preserve the lives of the occupied, to protect them, to do all kinds of things to make sure that their human dignity is not usurped from them. And so, yes, indeed, I totally agree that they haven't achieved any of their objectives, especially in relation to the current genocidal campaign. They haven't freed any of the hostages. They haven't eliminated Hamas, as they claim that they were doing. Instead, they were just applying collective punishment policies, killing everybody. And it is harrowing to hear what the UN Human Rights Council Special Rapporteur, Francesca Albanese, says today. She says, this is the genocide is in Gaza is so conspicuous and so ostentatious. And she's absolutely right. I'm quoting her verbatim there. She's absolutely right, because it's live. It's unfolding before the eyes of humanity all over the world. And yet these guys are arrogantly carrying on, and they assume that they're going to achieve something. And they are not going to. I totally agree with those who say that the people of Palestine have shown a remarkable, very moving fortitude and resilience and ability to resist their rather horrific, monstrous, nasty occupying force.
Right. Now, Shabir Rizvi, Ismail Haniyeh is saying that political support for the Tel Aviv regime is waning, and he cited the UN Security Council Monday resolution demanding a ceasefire. So we have pro-Palestine rallies in full swing around the world, as you know. We have Israel's allies, even their closest one, turning their backs. Boycotts of Israeli-made goods by a large number of countries underway. Severance of relations or limiting relations, summoning ambassadors, filing lawsuits in international fora. So what else could be in the offing?
Yeah, we're seeing multiple cascading effects of the October 7th resistance operation. Hamas has basically bloodied the nose of Israel to such an extent that they will never, ever be able to recover. I think what's going to happen now is a tightening of these different types of resistance that we're seeing, whether that's resistance directly on the ground from groups like Hamas or the PFLP, whether it's boycotts expanding. As you can see, more companies are being targeted to the point where sometimes even shipping lanes are being blocked, airports are being stopped by groups here in the United States, and there's just more general political pressure being added onto specifically the United States political apparatus. As you can see from the primary results coming in, a lot of voters are saying that they're uncommitted to Joe Biden, specifically as a protest vote, due to his direct complicity in this genocide. And I think that's where it hurts the political system the most, because Joe Biden has been the number one backer of this genocide. If it were not for his policies, this would not have gone to the extent that it has. Now that the political pressure is being applied to the number one financier and the number one political backer of the Zionist regime, things are going to start changing. And it's not only just the voting that's going to be taken into effect. If you look at what's happening on the ground in the United States, politicians are being made uncomfortable. They're having these fundraiser events where activists are popping up and shutting down the fundraiser event. Roadways are being blocked. Highways are being blocked. Entire docks are being blocked. And I think the United States is at risk of losing its own political legitimacy if it keeps backing this genocide. Because as you can see, there's millions of people on the streets collectively, not only in the United States, but across the entire world. They all support Palestine. In fact, the only people that are supporting the Israeli cause are specific Zionist groups, people that are tricked into supporting Zionism, and of course, the United States ruling class, who seeks to make, as Jared Kushner said, a port could, lead to a lot of revenue for the United States capitalist class. The people of the United States are directly at odds with their own ruling class. So why would they support some things? Why would they support Israel when they know that Israel is committing this genocide, is in bed with the ruling class that oppresses them day in and day out? There's no reason to support this. And the longer that the United States digs its heels into this genocide, the more contradictions arise between the population of the United States and the government of the United States, which clearly shows that it does not have the interests of the people at hand. It does not have the interest of peace and security at hand. Rather, it has the interests of a few select billionaire elite that want to expand their operations across West Asia and into Asia for their own personal gain.
Right. Turning to the humanitarian aid situation in Gaza, Kim, some people have been crushed to death, in a stampede. Some of them drowned while trying to get a drop from the air. Some of them were hit by those, airdrop aid. So this kind of, aid airdrop, has proved not only humiliating, but deadly. I mean, if the donors really want to help the people in Gaza, why don't they simply force Israel to open land crossings?
Indeed. I mean, that is the easiest and the quickest way and the honest, bona fide method of alleviating the suffering there vis-a-vis the humanitarian catastrophe aspect of it. You have to also look at who is creating that environment, who is doing this. It's the Israeli vicious regime. It's doing it because it uses hunger as a weapon of war. It wants to flatten out the whole of Gaza. The whole conflict is now becoming clear that it is about to do with the natural mineral resources of Gaza itself. Apparently, there's so much gas in the Sea of Gaza. There is a talk about turning Gaza into an attractive holiday resort, and said it by Jared Kushner. Now, the other day I saw an interview, horrified to hear. This is the ultimate psychopathy. You don't have to be a psychologist expert to identify these people are very, very sick and dangerous people, because they don't seem to appreciate the value of human life. They don't seem to appreciate the importance of preserving a human life. Instead, they think people can just be exterminated systematically, like they're doing it now, whether using hunger as a weapon of war or denying them access to basic necessities like medicine and water, and just outright shooting them and bulldozing them, and continue to attack the same hospital over and over again, raping women. There are allegations of rape taking place by the Israeli soldiers there. And it's month of Ramadan, people are fasting. We understand what it is to be hungry and thirsty. Can you imagine what it is like for the people of Gaza? That has been the situation for nearly 20 years for them, and now it's just been intensified. What needs to happen is, mm-hmm. just like Francesca Albanese, the special rapporteur at the Human Rights Council, said today, she's calling for sanctions and embargo on Israel. The whole world needs to now stop dealing with them, mm-hmm. literally kick their embassy ambassadors out, close down their embassies, and tell them, you're going to stop this systematic extermination of these people, or else we're not going to talk to you, we're not going to deal with you. Mm-hmm. And of course, we need to reprimand and maybe even have them investigated, those countries that have been creating a land passage for the Israeli vicious regime, whilst the Gazans are starving. The air dropping off the food was pretty Hollywood movie stunt to make it seem like they care. This is a classic example where a narcissist or a psychopath pretends to have empathy. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Sure.
So these guys are psychopaths, they are dangerous, and the Palestinian people need to be protected from the evils of these people.
All right. Now, Shabir, Israel saying it cannot defeat Hamas without going into Rafah, where it says the movement has 4 battalions composed of 1,000 fighters. Now, even if that is true, would that be the right thing? I mean, to wipe out the entire population there to achieve the goal?
No, of course not. There's no reason for this siege to even be happening in the first place. And I'm not just even talking about after October 7th. I'm talking about the history of the besiegement of Gaza. What they're asking to do, what they're trying to gain approval for before they do it, is genocide, is ethnic cleansing. There are hundreds of thousands, there's 1 million people in there. It's the last place they have to go. And guaranteed, no matter what they do, as we have seen time and time again, year after year, they say that they have targeted bombings. That's just simply not true. Their bombs are unguided, and what they're trying to do is massacre as many people as possible. They're trying to force them out. There is nothing surgical about this. And even if it was, this is a full-blown occupation, and it is an illegal occupation. Hamas has every right to exist. Any resistance group has any right to exist. Illegal occupation. This is under the UN's own law. What they're trying to do here is bend laws, is take advantage of the fact that they are politically and militarily backed by the United States, and commit a massacre of untold proportions. We have never seen anything like this in history, where such a sophisticated military has backed all these people into a specific corner, has deprived them of food and medicine, has broken them psychologically, has broken them physically, and now wants to finish them off. They're asking the world for permission to commit a massacre that will surely finish off the population of Gaza, and they want the world's approval to do it, but they have become so illegitimized, they have become a pariah state, and they're going to be unable to do this. And now they're trying to make a gamble at it and say that they're going to go in, and it's just not going to work out for them. This objective that they have of destroying Hamas is not going to work. And they don't even consider that every time that they kill a Palestinian, who else is going to rise up to the task of joining the resistance and fight back?
Right.
This is something that they are not considering whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Now, Kim, in terms of the truce talks, you know, Qatar is saying that the adoption of the UN Security Council resolution has not had any immediate effect on the talks, for now, at least. The Israeli media said the talks had fallen through. They blame Hamas's response to a U.S. proposal for a prisoner swap. Now, Hamas is saying that Israel is entirely responsible for the failure of the negotiation efforts. So do you see a ceasefire deal around the corner?
I do hope so, but I can imagine, I mean, you know, going on a high-level negotiation meetings of this sort, it's a very tense atmosphere. I mean, as a commercial lawyer, I have attended these negotiation sessions. It's a very, very tense atmosphere. And you need to have parity between the negotiating parties, if you know what I mean. In the sense of, like, they need to be of equal strength. But here we've got two parties of totally unequal strength. One party, which is supremacist in its ideology, in its position, in its assumption, it thinks it is superior to all other humans. And of course, in relation to Hamas, it sees itself as even more superior, and it sees Hamas as a mere hodgepodge of terror militia, which is not true, and they know it. But and so having negotiations in a room like that, it is filled with contempt by one side to the other side, and another side trying to uphold its rights with all it can, despite all the obstacles that it has in front of it. So it's a very difficult scenario, and I can imagine, I commend all those mediators who are in there, who are maintaining the peace in there. And so... I hope there will be. I hope somebody will tell Israel, for God's sake, listen, the whole world now is aware of your heinous crimes. The whole world sees you as a proper psychopath. This is what you need to tell your client when you are negotiating like that, and you know your client is unreasonable.
Okay.
You have to bear upon them and tell them, listen, you are going to have to come enter into a deal here, and if you don't, then it's going to backfire on you very, very badly.
Okay. On that note, we come to the end of this episode of the Spotlight. I apologize for that. Kim Sharif, activist and lawyer, join me from London. Shabir Rezvi, political commentator from Chicago. Appreciate it.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 23, 2015 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with government officials on the occasion of the month of Ramadan. On the issue of the economy, I should say that the month of Ramadan is the month of piety. What is piety? Piety means constant care of ourselves so that we do not take the wrong path and do not get stuck in the thorns of problems. Piety is in fact an armor that a pious person wears. It protects him from the harm caused by poisonous arrows and deadly spiritual blows. Of course, this harm is not confined to spiritual matters. And for those who fear Allah, He prepares a way out. He provides for him from sources he never could imagine. The Holy Quran chapter 66, verses 2 to 3. Piety has many important effects, even in worldly affairs. This is personal piety. The same thing holds true for society and a country.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
What is the piety of a country? What is the piety of a society? A society, particularly if it has lofty and elevated ideals like the Islamic Republic society, is under constant attack. It is subject to attacks launched with poisonous arrows. This requires piety as well. What is social piety? Social piety can be defined for different areas. In the area of the economy, social piety means the economy of resistance. If we want to avoid the harm caused by global fluctuations, or if we want to avoid the poisonous arrows that are fired by hostile policies in the world, we have no option other than turning to the economy of resistance. The economy of resistance is an element of strength in the face of all those people and powers that use all their economic, political, media, and security capacities in order to deliver a blow to our people, our country, and our system. One of the ways that they have found until today is penetration through economy.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all